VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, welcome to the Game Football Podcast from The Times. It's Monday the 28th of December. We are deep in the Christmas schedule. We'll be looking back at another special weekend of games in the Premier League for you. Arsenal taking a big step towards resurrecting their season with victory over a pretty lackluster Chelsea. Is Frank Lampard under more pressure than we think at Stamford Bridge? Elsewhere, Spurs fail to win again. Do they need to change that defensive style? And Big Sam's West Brom shine at Anfield. Also, has Stockley Park chilled out a little bit when it comes to VAR? And do you think that is a good or a bad thing? Plenty for us to discuss. To help me through it all, hello, season's greetings, shall we say, to Gregor Robertson, Alison Rudd and Matt Dickinson. How are you doing?
Good, thanks. Saved a fox's life over Christmas, on Christmas Day, in fact. It's a Christmas miracle.
You went out into the backyard where your bear traps were set and you accidentally caught a fox, had you?
I had a fox with mange and I got some special medicine and some antibiotics for her.
That's above and beyond, Alison.
I know. It's a true Christmas miracle. Where did you discover said fox? In the back garden, I take it?
Yeah, she's a regular mummy fox.
I see.
Whose fur started to disappear and... honestly, if I told you the protocol for curing her, it involves testing that she'd eat the right cake. And then when I saw her eat the right cake, I knew I could inject this very powerful medicine, but I'm not allowed to give it to her unless I can see her eating it because no other animal's allowed to eat it. So I had to inject that medicine. Then I have to give her a course of antibiotics. And then I have to entice her into the garden with giblets and things so that I know she's going to come. And then I give her something even more delicious to put the antibiotics in. And it takes a week.
I admire your compassion. I know what most residents of Southwest London, including my dogs, would like to do to foxes, but so makes you all the more admirable.
And as is customary for a couple of days after Christmas as well, we've got to discuss what gifts we were given. You know, who's the big winner out of the four of us when it comes to Christmas presents? I was delighted with my boxer shorts, my Lindt chocolates, and I got a lovely, lovely sweater from Ralph Lauren as well. Delighted with that. Any special gifts this year, Gregor?
I told you, my presents are in Scotland still, so it's quite nice.
I forgot.
Beyond a few books about fatherhood, impending fatherhood.
Oh, congratulations. Yes. I had no idea.
That was the most exciting present. In fact, I got one called FC Dad, which was hilarious. It's got kind of a picture of, I'll show it up to you, a picture of... the child being held up like the World Cup by Bobby Moore, and then kind of every chapter is kind of themed. It's like the loan system when you've got to look after daycare for the children and things like that. That was my best present, I think. Only present, though.
Matt?
I was going to say, Greg, you can read all you like. It'll still be a mad panic of,
yeah, probably, yeah.
of screw-ups like the rest of us, I'm sure. But joyous screw-ups, I should hasten to add. As you say, the usual socks and boxer shorts. What was my, I got a few interesting books. Matthew McConaughey's I'm about to tuck into, actually, which looks a good read. So, my birthday's not long before Christmas, so I always think I get ripped off a bit, to be honest,
Apart from the fitness and exercise side of things, you don't strike me as a particular Matthew McConaughey fan. Is this something that we didn't know about?
No, you sort of lays his soul bare. I like any autobiography where someone lets it all hang out, and which he, you know, even judging from the first couple of pages, he certainly does. I admire. So, yeah. No, I'm You don't think I model myself on Matthew McConaughey and all sorts of what's the difference between me and that Hollywood pinup that you don't quite see?
Ali, apart from the newly formed halo over your head after rescuing Serge Potts, your Christmas? What were you blessed with this year?
I was blessed with a hell of a lot, actually. So I'm going to keep it modest and just mention I got one of those cycle jackets that illuminate really, really brightly when there's a car behind you. So when I'm cycling along to Stamford Bridge or Craven Cottage or wherever, I know I'll be safe. So that was nice.
Good, good, good. I'm glad everyone had an enjoyable Christmas. And Gregor, I hope you get a chance to nip up to Scotland at some point soon and get hold of your presents as well, particularly for your partner. There was a much needed Christmas gift for the Arsenal boss, Mikel Arteta, this weekend, because Frank Lampard's Chelsea really helped him out, to be honest. It was a woeful showing from them in the London derby on Boxing Day. They lost 3-1, Chelsea, and I've got to say, I don't think Arsenal had to do particularly much to win on the day. They were in need of a result. They came and played like a team that was in need of a result. A penalty, free kick, lucky goal, in my opinion. But really, they'd still deserve the victory because Chelsea didn't do anywhere near enough to even get a draw out of the game. Matt, do you think they were complacent, Chelsea?
Well, that very word was put to Frank afterwards, which, you know, I mean, he was pretty harsh on his players. He balked at that, said he didn't think it was complacent, although did use words like lethargic and lazy. I mean, I think that there were some very guilty parties, but in different ways. I thought it's interesting, actually, because some of the subs were, Chelsea subs were sat right in front of me, and there was a couple of times when Timo Werner was through and basically avoided the chance to go directly for goal. You could just see his confidence of that shot, that he didn't want to put himself on in the sort of pressure of missing a chance. And there was a couple of the Chelsea subs were screaming at him from around us, which probably didn't do much for his confidence either. But so I think there were different problems in different areas. You've got that Werner issue where that's, you know, an individual's lack of confidence. I think there was a bit of the midfield collectively, you know, Arteta had clearly obviously set out Arsenal to get around them, which, you know, Xhaka and Elneny, we sort of know what they're about. But I think obviously it was the Smith Rowe sort of part of it that was smart from Arteta, brought him in, and he didn't just work as a playmaker, but was getting around Kante very effectively. And suddenly Kovacic was taken off at halftime as well. Obviously, even Kante looked like, you know, sort of the game was too fast for him, which, you know, how many times are you going to say that? And also the fact that Arsenal were pressing down the flanks and the switch to a back four meant that the fullbacks were getting forward. And both Chelsea's fullbacks were having really poor games. Even, you know, Reece James, we've lauded a lot early in the season, but he had a poor game, I thought. So In every different area, I thought Arsenal were just that bit sharper, but maybe for different reasons.
I'll come to the youngsters of Arsenal in a moment with Gregor, but Alisson, that Chelsea performance, do you see the team sort of creaking slightly at the moment? Sort of they seem like they were going to get things together, and now it's really coming apart, fraying. And maybe that's because of some of the recent drops in form of certain players. Other players, the likes of Olivier Giroud, coming into the team, now out of the team. You know, that rhythm seems to have been disrupted.
Yeah, there are a lot of problems at Chelsea, I think. And I wasn't expecting them. I was expecting them to go on a sort of gradual trajectory and to be fairly certain of a top three finish, actually. And I didn't see this coming. It's weird. I think Matt's right. I think actually it stems from Werner, because the formation's wrong, and I don't know why Frank's persisting with it, because putting Werner on the left seems to have it seems to sort of ruin his confidence with each passing minute. I was at the previous game at the Bridge against West Ham, which Chelsea won and shouldn't have, in terms of they were poor, really poor. And it's interesting that Matt noted that people were shouting at Timo from the subs bench, because when you're there, you can hear who the backroom staff and the subs are yelling to. And in that game as well, it was all you could hear was Timo, Timo, like a naggy mum, a kid not doing the clearing their room up. It was, and with each passing shout from the touchline, his shoulders drooped. He looked really uninterested. And then you look at it and you think, well, why are you playing him if he's so dispirited, making lots of mistakes, not having an impact on the game? Why are you playing him? Why are you persisting on playing him in the wrong place? If you're under pressure to play him because he cost you money and he's a signing that the club are proud of, then play him where he wants to play, which is more centrally. So he's. I think one problem that Chelsea have is this persistence with the formation of 4-3-3, and they don't quite have the personnel, or he's not putting the personnel where he should put them if he wants to play 4-3-3. And it makes Lampard look like he's just trying to be Liverpool in disguise without having the players to do it. And it's not a good team when he felt against West Ham, Frank Lampard thought that Kovacic was the saviour for that game. And then to go from that, and he did improve the team in that match. And then for that to go from, oh, I've solved it, I've put Kov in midfield. And then for Kovacic, Matt, you gave him 4 out of 10. So he must have been pretty poor because he's a good player. For the next game, that should work, shouldn't it? You've worked out, it's going to work a bit better if I've got Kovacic there. And it didn't work. So it's very hard to know what Frank Lampard is trying to achieve, or if he's trying to overachieve and play a system that he doesn't quite have the players for.
Is you find it hard, Matt, just to balance out the number of quality players in his side? Because I mentioned them losing a bit of rhythm with all the changes they've been making. He had a couple of players get injured, a couple come back from injuries, trying to integrate everyone. That hasn't helped.
Yeah, not only it has helped, although, yeah, but I think it really sensed, sort of listening to him talk that a little bit, that he was slightly groping around himself for. I mean, he is, and this is not to excuse him, because ultimately he's in charge of that big job and expected to deliver. But he this is a guy who's learning on the job, and he sounded a bit like a manager was as surprised as anyone to see Chelsea so flat in that first half. They did improve second half. Pulisic got on the ball more, started running at people. I actually felt a bit sorry for Tammy Abraham. I didn't think he had a particularly sort of good, scored obviously, but you could actually see that he was trying to make things happen and trying to get involved and try and improve the performance. And actually Callum Hudson-Odoi came on and lifted the energy a bit. So that there was an improvement after half time. But yeah, I think Frank was genuinely, which is why he made those two changes at half time. They were a real sort of kick up the backside type changes. This is not good enough. But it felt like a manager who was sort of shocked by his own team's ineptitude, which is never a great look.
Alisson, the watching world was screaming out for Olivier Giroud to come off the bench after about 20 minutes, let alone at half time. And then when they made their final substitution, I don't think anyone could really understand it. Could you?
Well, no, because this isn't just about the fact that I think Giroud is a class act. It's if you're putting in crosses, and Reece James might not have had his best game, but he was putting in crosses. I mean, the fullbacks were putting in crosses. Who deals with crosses best? Olivier Giroud. He'll either hold it up, flick it on, or score with it. He's going to do something with a cross. And if you're losing control of the game, he's very good at that sort of hold up play, reading the game, bringing in the younger players. So bizarre. I can only assume he overplayed Giroud, and now he's a bit tired, and his stats in training aren't great. That can be the only reason, I think. It feels to me there are power plays at work at that club, that Lampard isn't just managing a team. He's managing people higher up as well, and that there may be pressure on him to make sure he gives time to the players that have cost money.
We'll pick up on Frank Lampard and some of the pressures in his job in a moment. But as I said, much needed Christmas gift for Mikel Arteta in the opposite dugout. Gregor, Arsenal were solid. In particular, their youngsters showed the way, really. Gabriel Martinelli, Emil Smith-Rowe, Bukayo Saka, who got himself on the score sheet. Are those sorts of players, those younger players at Arsenal, not just their future, but really their now, with the likes of Willian and Aubameyang maybe being cast aside slightly?
Saka definitely is the future. I think Martinelli is a you know, his return is a big boost because he gives them something, that dynamism and a bit of spark and energy that they didn't really have, or certainly Willian wasn't offering. And Rowe was excellent. You know, he's full of industry and running and kind of, you know, it wasn't just when he got on the ball. He was really good defensively and worked hard. So, you know, he was a surprise and a welcome surprise for Arteta, I would think. But there is something about just having three young guys, you know, teenagers that are still kind of trying to make their way in the game. Bit of fearlessness, and that's a bit of a cliche. It doesn't always work. It's, you know, fearlessness can sometimes be, you know, the players can be actually slightly too gung-ho even. But there is something about having three young players like that, a bit of energy, a bit more, it's like a connection to the club as well when they've come through. Martinelli's not, but come through the academy and they've got a bit of connection to Arsenal. I think that provides something that Arsenal needed, rather than looking around at guys who, you know, if Aubameyang and Willian are in there, two guys who are earning huge, huge money and have been a disappointment so far this season, and, you know, they're possibly associated with, fairly or not, with what Arsenal have become a bit, you know, kind of slightly aging players who are perhaps who are earning a lot of money and perhaps not really living up to their billing at the moment. So this is a complete contrast to that, putting these three guys in. And I thought they performed brilliantly. So, I mean, at the same time, I think coming back to Chelsea allowed them to perform so well almost. They had so much room and time on the ball. Saka's goal was just remarkable, how they kind of travelled the length of the pitch. Saka picked up the ball just outside the box and kind of waltzed into it completely unchallenged. Chelsea looked really tired. It was almost, I don't know, you can't say that they were fatigued, but there were certain players who did look really kind of leggy and weary. And sometimes that's just to do with when you're getting overrun. It's not necessarily fatigue. It's you're getting overrun. They didn't really know. There was no kind of solutions from Lampard, I didn't think. Arsenal were dominating down the flanks and they, you know, threw on Hudson-Odoi to try and send them back the other way. It didn't really work. There was no solutions in the game to the problems that Arsenal were posing for Chelsea. So that would be my biggest worry if I was a Chelsea fan. What did Lampard do in a game that were dominated really until the end? What did he do to change that? I know he threw on Hudson-Odoi, as I say, and he created a spark, but none of it was to counter what Arsenal were throwing at them.
Matt, I didn't think it would happen this quickly, but the issue of players on big contracts at Arsenal around their 30th birthday or thereafter, Willian and Aubameyang seem to already, having firstly Aubameyang signed his new deal not too long ago and Willian only arriving in the summer, be an issue for Mikel Arteta. Do you think that is the case, or will they contribute more?
Well, I mean, I think the good thing about this performance is that, you know, there was a sort of, I mean, apart from just the win itself and an emphatic win, but it felt like it was a setting of standards for a manager that, you know, you suddenly, you know, as Gregor says, Martinelli, I thought, I mean, he's still regaining his full sharpness, but just the energy he brought, the running he brought, suddenly you thought, well, yeah, there is no tolerance even for Aubameyang, for the size of his contract, the stature he's got at the club. Suddenly you say, well, look, this is what you're expected to contribute. And I think that was, you know, I think the manager will need to be brave enough now that if Aubameyang comes in and doesn't perform with that energy, that he's taken off. You know, that's the sort of standard that's been set now. I mean, I'm surprised at the Willian one. To be honest, the couple of games I saw at the start of the season, I thought he might prove to be, you know, a pretty sensible signing. Maybe, you know, whatever he's earning, you know, maybe in a sort of reasonably expensive one at that age with no resale. But I still thought that he would fit. So I'm surprised it's not worked out better. But again, maybe if the whole club gets its energy back, he'll be forced to start, you know, contributing more. And that's the thing. I think it's Arteta getting to a position where he can make hard decisions from a position of strength. I think that's the crucial thing he needs to, because even Ozil is going to come back into the debate January. You can bring him back into the squad. if you can make that decision from a different place, you might make a different decision. But it's being in that place where you feel like, okay, I've now got things in a better place. I do think, you know, we haven't talked much about the tactics, but I do think that made a difference. I do, you know, not saying it's every game, maybe he's going to change it around, but actually getting some attacking fullbacks going and changing that system. I thought, I've mentioned it in a couple of pieces, the games I've seen recently, the system he was trying to play, the players looked like they were being overcoached. They looked like they were sort of trying to do something that they weren't quite sure how to do it. And I thought there was something more simplifying in this system, something a bit more liberating in that. And, you know, I think he should stick with that for a while as well, because I felt, okay, maybe there are certain risks because Holding and Pablo Mari is not the greatest centre-back partnership in the Premier League, that's for sure. But I just thought there was something that, say, just liberated the team a little bit. And I think that's crucial as well.
I'd agree with you. I went to that game in the League Cup against Manchester City, and all the joy that Arsenal had on the game, I was talking to Andy Townsend about it. It was just like a little bit of freedom, a bit more direct. I think we said that was a bit more British at one point. You know, someone just knocked the ball wide and delivered it into the box. Wow, unbelievable coaching and football, but it worked and they got a goal from it. So maybe I think simplifying things slightly, you're right, for Mikel Arteta might work for them. Gregor, I know Alisson was talking about this very briefly, but I did want to talk about Frank Lampard's role. They're eighth in the table now, 3 defeats in their last 4 league games. The pressure for the manager at Stamford Bridge is something we've seen a lot. And it almost felt like, because he's a club legend, you know, Frank Lampard might not get the same pressure that other managers have had. But it feels now we're moving into the territory, you know, into the final half of his second season, if you like, where Roman Abramovich usually makes a decision on whether his managers stay or go. How much pressure do you think Frank Lampard is under?
Well, the Premier League is this tight. I don't think he's under immediate pressure, but, you know, he's got to be closer to the summit of the league this season, I think, after that spending and with the squad at his disposal. You know, we're talking about how he fits players into a system. He's got, or whether the system is correct for these players, he's got enough options to play that system. He's got enough players who can play in that system. And so Werner can play on the left. He did it for Leipzig. It's just that they looked like a much more dynamic team, Leipzig. And he's someone who's got to find those gaps between the fullback and the centre half and be picked out. And Chelsea at the moment don't look like they're making those transitions quickly. They just looked a little bit laboured. You know, they have done this season, and they have players of, you know, Ziyech and players like that who can create some fantastic opportunities. But they just look a little bit sluggish. And it was interesting, his reaction too, in that he basically came out and blamed it all on the players. And, you know, that doesn't always kind of go down very well, I don't think. And I think it's a bit of an easy option too. I don't think, you know, you can say that the players performed poorly there, but as I say again, there wasn't any solutions in the game. They were stretched. Arsenal had so much space all over the pitch, particularly midfield. Kante looked like, you know, he's running around and there was no real assistance. And there was nothing really done during the game to rectify that. So I don't think it'd be wise for him to keep laying it all on the players if they're playing poorly. I don't think that'll end well for him personally.
And also, in the history of Chelsea under Abramovich, managers who fall out with players or have a go at players do not last long. They don't like it. I mean, you know, Sarri, for all his personality issues, it was really that he wouldn't play Callum Hudson-Odoi. Even though he said, "Well, I do." As soon as it becomes perceived that a manager is not getting on with a player or is prepared to publicly say what a player's weaknesses are, I mean, you say Frank laid it on the players. He actually name-checked Werner, saying he expected more from him on the pitch and off the pitch. I mean, that the history of Chelsea means that's a bad move. You just don't do that at Chelsea. The players are treated like, well, they're treated a bit like gods, and managers are treated as dispensable. And once you go down that path, it's a dangerous one, even though Frank Lampard has more goodwill behind him than any previous manager because of his iconic status at the club. Already, we're seeing that slightly erode. People are forgetting, you know, fans are forgetting that they love Frank Lampard. They're now in love with certain players and wanting to see them, you know, they're excited at the spending in the summer and they want to see that come to fruition. They don't want to see their manager saying, oh, they're not doing enough, because who carries the can for that? It can only be the manager.
Particularly after a summer spend like that, there really aren't any excuses for him now. It's like you looked last season and you thought you need a bit of leadership, and you signed Thiago Silva at the back, and people who should be able to organise on the pitch and lead on the pitch as well. So, you know, he's had all the opportunities to improve the squad in the areas he feels it needed improved. There really isn't any excuse.
And also he's had one battle, hasn't he? He's had one battle, which was getting rid of Kepa. Well, not getting rid of him, but you know what I mean, bringing in a new keeper. That was slightly dangerous ground for a bit, because basically saying to the hierarchy, oh, you spent loads of dosh, I don't think it's good enough. That's one battle he's won. He can't keep doing that.
He did say, Frank Lampard, at the start of the season, that he was harshly judged because he was a young English manager. I remember I wasn't very happy with it. We discussed it on the podcast. It's getting to the point I don't think he's criticised enough. You mentioned the team selections, the formations, the squad that's available to him. And in particular, Gregor, those in-match reactions that we expect from managers, where they really sort of, we see the difference between a coach and a great manager, you know, the substitutions, the changing of approach during a 90 minutes. Matt, he at times he doesn't seem to have it at all.
Like I said to you, I mean, it sounds like I'm making excuses for him. I think he's learning. I mean, you know, it'd be weird if he wasn't. I think he's bright enough to learn, but it's almost like, well, his where he's at out of kilter with where Chelsea need to be when you've spent the money we've just talked about and you have the squad they have. I mean, with that squad, yes, they should be, you know, up there. I mean, Liverpool have obviously got an established pattern. Chelsea need to be top 2, 3, 4 with that squad. And so, yeah, that's the expectation. At the same time, you know, Frank is learning, making mistakes as he does so. So I think it's whether he can sort of run fast enough to keep up with those Chelsea expectations. I don't think I'd be giving up hope on that yet. But, you know, as the guys have just said, it's Chelsea's not a place where you want to fall too far behind that curve, especially given the political dimensions that we know there.
The football comes pretty thick and fast at the moment, so Chelsea will have the opportunity to get back to winning ways a little bit later on against Aston Villa, who've been excellent themselves of late. We're going to stick with a London theme, though, generally speaking, after that game between Chelsea and Arsenal. We'll move across to Spurs, because they're on a pretty torrid run themselves in the Premier League. Just one win in their last 6 league games. It likely means their title challenge is already over, but I'll wait to put the death knell on it completely until about the end of January, Spurs fans. But who knows? Who knows? They might come back into it as well. The main criticism has been their style of play, and I think we all knew what Jose Mourinho wanted to do. Great when it works and you're winning games, isn't it, Spurs fans? Not so great to watch when you're not. Having scored after 57 seconds against Wolves, Spurs' final shot on target came on just the 21st minute as they drew 1-1 at Molineux. Matt, are the Spurs fans right, do you think, to be unhappy about Jose Mourinho's approach?
Well, it depends what you thought you were going to get from Jose Mourinho's approach. I mean, you know, if you're one of those guys who said, well, I'll take him because, you know, I think he can drag us up a bit, and certainly from where they were, and, you know, we'll get games like this, but I'll take it for a couple of years, which is, you know, generally before people get sick of him, then, you know, then fine. If you're one of those ones who said this is going to be dull as hell because I've seen a lot of Jose football, then you'll be sitting there saying, you know, I told you so. I mean, it's no one should be shocked, should they, really? I think there is, you know, I think the disappointment, I guess, for Spurs fans is that they've seen better, and I think there's something maddening about when you're throwing away points against, I mean, Wolves are obviously a good team, but it's happened, isn't it, against Newcastle, against Palace as well, I think, isn't it? Where's that sort of get one up and sort of, you know, retreat? It's, you know, there may be a sense in sort of Jose part of the bus at Anfield, but there is a natural caution which is undermining them. And, you know, that's clearly daft, because in a weird season where
you know, Spurs are more than capable of in this sort of league, should be capable of coming second, then to start slipping as they are is certainly a frustration.
Gregory, sort of being accused at the moment, Jose Mourinho, of almost misusing the quality players that he has at his disposal by playing like this. What do you think?
That summed up. It's when they, you know, they took 7 points from the games against Man City, Chelsea and Arsenal. They were unlucky against Liverpool, I thought, because there is sense in going to Liverpool and playing a certain way, because that's the best way to win the game. But is this the best way to win the game against Wolves? Was it against... It was a carbon copy of the Palace game, really. When they take the lead and then they try and hold on and hold on and hold on, and they've now conceded... I think they've dropped 9 points from goals conceded in the last 10 minutes. So it's not working. I think, you know, part of that, you've got to kill the game. And there's something about the goals return as well. In the early part of the season, they were scoring, you know, they were prolific. Kane and Son working together. That's dipped a little bit too. So the games aren't being put to bed. And it's, you know, when you're 2 or 3 nil up and you play like that, you think, fair enough. It's, you know, why wouldn't you? But when you're playing against Wolves and you score early, Wolves not being on a fantastic run, these are the games that Spurs think they should be going and imposing themselves on, and they've got the players to do so. So, yeah, Matt's right. I mean, what did they expect? This is it. The thing is, and we've discussed this many times this season, is you're not given as much leeway when you play this way, and the results don't come. If the Spurs were playing like they were under Pochettino, and they got a 1-1 draw, and it was a kind of buccaneering game, and they'd really gone to win it. You know, the fans would go, okay, you know, at least we're having a go, and it was fun. But it's not with Jose Mourinho at the helm a lot of the time. This is going to be a cycle, I think. He'll go on and win, he'll grind out results, win games, possibly against the bigger teams as well, find it easier. And then these games will come round and Wolves will look better than them, Palace will look better than them, or certainly more adventurous. And the grumbles will start again. They'll start quicker than they would if they were a bit more enterprising.
Although I think it's that fun word. The fans will have their say in it, but at the moment, not inside the stadium. I think the more interesting dynamic is almost with the players, of how much, you know, I think we've spoke about this before when they were on a good run, in that, because these players have not won anything, they were willing to buy, you know, the likes of Harry Kane and Son and, you know, so many others have been willing to buy into the Mourinho style, however frustrating it is, because they think it's going to get them somewhere. That, you know, even if for Harry Kane that means defending on the edge of his own penalty area for 75 minutes. But that is something you're willing to sacrifice when you think it is going to get you somewhere, i.e. to your hands on a trophy. You start questioning in it when it isn't, and when things aren't, you know, work, you're not getting that side of the bargain, basically. So I think that is the really interesting dynamic, I think, to watch, of just how players find that when they're, you know, being asked to stifle themselves, to be cautious, which isn't to say it isn't going to work, and isn't going to say they're not going to get into the top four again, you know, be a top four team this season.
Gregor, what was it like to have your creative freedom stifled by a manager?
Oh, it was awful. Awful. I'm afraid I can't really can't emphasize with that. I quite like being the guy who was defended for 90 minutes and winning on the break. I was a centre half or a left back. So, but the other interesting thing I'd say quickly say about Mourinho is his demeanour again after the game. It was, he almost threw the players under the bus without throwing them under it. He said, I don't want to speak. He just kept saying, I don't want to speak. You know, when he's asked questions about why this was happening or who, you know, he said, you know how I work when in terms of the organisation and things like that. And there was, you know, they highlighted him pointing out to Bergwijn the place he should be from the set piece at which they scored. So he basically was throwing somebody on the bus without kind of naming them individually. And, you know, we saw in the documentary, the Amazon documentary, did highlight and sort of illuminate that he's not, no matter how dour and kind of miserable he can seem to us, he's not really like that behind the scenes. And, you know, maybe we, that's a kind of, I don't know, it's a narrative that we kind of get caught up in a little bit. It's perhaps not quite as important behind the scenes, but he's, you know, we were a few weeks ago, I mean, Matt wrote a piece saying that he looked like he'd found his, you know, he was happy again, which we're all delighted to see. And now, you know, a few results and he slips back into his old ways.
Alison, Jose Mourinho has been accused of being too proud or too stubborn over the way he plays. But actually, a bit like Greg is saying there, he accused his players after the match of lacking ambition. Whose responsibility is it, his or the players?
That's the really strange thing about this discussion, isn't it? That he came out and said he told them at halftime to have more ambition and they were unable to do it. I mean, is in a way, if he's by saying that, isn't he admitting that he hasn't coached them well enough to be able to shift through the different passages of play that he needs them to execute? Because what they look like against Wolves was like they've been sucked into quicksand and they couldn't get out. And who knows what their feet were doing under the sand, but they weren't able to change anything. The pattern was set. It was just so rigid and almost a parody of what you expect a Mourinho team to be. It was a bit laughable. And yet for him to come out and say, oh, actually, I didn't tell them to do that. I actually wanted them to play free-flowing football and really go for it. That, to me, that's a bit of a mistake for him to say that. Because if he's told them to do it, that must mean he's coached them to be able to shift from protecting a lead to being more open and aggressive in their play and exploiting the great talent they have. It's not that long ago I was writing and saying on this podcast that actually Spurs are a very attractive team to go and watch because the way they break is scintillating and wonderful, and Son in full flow is a joy to behold. And all he did against Wolves was, I mean, he did good things. He harried and he defended, but I mean, that's not what I want to watch when I watch Son, is it? So it's bizarre. It's utterly bizarre that he took that tack post-match to say, oh, I wanted them to do something else and they didn't do it. That's his fault.
Matt, in a word, can they still win the title?
Well, I don't think so. I mean, I think everything depends on Liverpool, doesn't it? If Liverpool play as they can, but then, you know, they've, as we know, juggling obviously defensive resources. They had another hitch with that with Matip at the weekend. So, but I think if Liverpool, you know, do what they are capable of, then everyone else is playing for second.
Well, it's Liverpool we'll discuss next on the Game Podcast. But remember, if you enjoy it, you can give us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcast or whichever you use. But you've got to make sure you're subscribed to make sure you don't miss the next episode. Get yourself a digital subscription to The Times or The Sunday Times. You can get it on all of your devices as well. Sign up today. You'll get yourself 1 month free. Just go online, search thetimes.co.uk/thegame to get yourself started.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Well, let's talk Liverpool next. It finished Liverpool 1, West Bromwich Albion 1 at Anfield. It had all the hallmarks, I think, of Sam Allardyce's blueprint, West Brom's performance. It was stubborn defensively. They were waiting for their moment to pounce and steal a result. Except Alisson Rudd, I think it's fair to say West Brom really deserve this point.
Yeah, I was slightly amused that afterwards both managers were intent on not having a repeat of the best team lost fiasco that happened when Spurs went to Anfield and did something similar. Klopp went out of his way to say West Brom deserved their point, and Sam Allardyce went out of his way to say it was hard work and they're a wonderful team and it took a lot of effort to gain that point. It was another bizarre... I mean, you do get them at Christmas, actually, anyway. Boxing Day is always really weird. And that period of Christmas throws up some very strange games to watch. It wasn't like watching football. It was, I don't know what it was like, a bit like watching a ballet you don't like very much to some pretty crap music. I mean, it was pretty, but it wasn't enthralling. And there were no patterns to it. It was just the same thing over and over again. You could have just watched it at any point and it would have looked the same. All I can say is I think Klopp was slightly hard on his players and on himself. And I think West Brom were fantastic because they actually did what Tottenham could not do at Wolves, which was change and, you know, spring a surprise. Their concentration was impressive. I mean, it's asking a lot to have everyone camped where they were camped and to not even try and break out. And it can become a bit dizzying and a bit difficult and probably quite depressing, but they kept going and then were able in the second half to look just spring the odd surprise, look a bit, do a few different things. So how can Sam Allardyce come in and coach a team to be able to have split personality, and Jose Mourinho isn't able to do that, having been there for you know, what is it, 18 times as long or something? I mean, it's just ridiculous. So full credit, I go along with Klopp and say full credit to Big Sam. Whatever you think of him, he thinks really long and hard about the tactics for every single game.
Gregor, just take us through what you think makes a Big Sam team so different, because West Brom haven't struggled massively against the bigger side. So actually, it's not the most surprising result. Of course, they drew 1-1 with Manchester City. They only lost by a goal against Man United and against Spurs as well. They drew with Chelsea earlier on in the season. But of course, it was a different approach to what Slaven Bilic would have put on the pitch as well. So what makes Big Sam's teams a Big Sam side?
Well, looking at this game, the fact that they were almost playing with six at the back, I don't, you know, Bilic, let's be honest, Bilic is a fairly conservative coach. He was at West Ham. He was, you know, he was with West Brom in the Championship. They scored a lot of goals, but you know, this season, as you say, they were probably, you know, they were decent against the big teams, but they struggled to when they had to impose themselves. They were a bit like Spurs, just a kind of poorer version. And they don't. There's more kind of logic to it too, because they don't have the players that Spurs do. So what makes a Big Sam team? Yeah, just, you know, incredible organization. And when you looked at them defending, it wasn't like they were defending even just the box. It was almost narrower than that. They were so compact, just defending that the goal and not allowing any space for, you know, the places that Salah and Mane kind of drop into that are just pockets between the centre half and the left back, just in front of them to get the ball and turn on, run at the defence. So there was just no space for Liverpool. And Alisson's right. I think the second half was completely different in that they moved up the pitch, and you know, Grant's got pace. Carlin Grant's got real pace up front, and he worked his socks off. And I think the other thing is getting players like Diangana and Robinson, who are, you know, a forward thinking attacking players, to do that job for 90 minutes, to be the white guys who are almost filling in as fullbacks and be, you know, to do that ugly side of the game. So I think that's the thing that Allardyce does. He gets, you know, I think if they don't do that, they won't play for him. But he gets players to play for them. He's always been able to do that. He engages players, and that's a, you know, that's arguably the most important thing about management. It's those people skills and getting people to want to do it for you and for the team and for themselves and for each other. So that's what Big Sam's always done, along with the organisation. And I would say they deserve something from the game as well.
Maybe it's a change in mentality, because I loved Sam Allardyce's little punch to the air when they equalised, because it wasn't like, we're West Brom, little West Brom, we've equalised against Liverpool. It was just like, oh, we've got our goal now, you know, and it's not going to be a huge result that I'm going to run away with. You know, it's just an equaliser away at Anfield. You know, that's just what West Brom should be doing. I really like that, because I expected the bench to go up as if it was, I don't know, midnight on New Year's Eve, and everyone was just like, yeah, but it wasn't. It was just like, get in, lads. Well done. You deserved it. Let's get back out there, see what we can do. Maybe we'll get another. And I sort of like that. Maybe, Matt, he's changing them from being a side that should be looking at the Premier League as if every point is some, or every game is some sort of cup final for us, and just actually establishing them as like, this is where we should be as a club, and these games are going to be regular, and so will these results.
Well, I think that's exactly what he brings. There's a certain the experience, the assurance that comes with that, as Gregor says. I think it's clarity. I think that is really what he brings above all. As Gregor says, clarity of tactical plan, clarity of man-to-man management, and you know, it's these people have been, you know, sniffy about him all the way through, the same as Harry Redknapp had it in a different way, but it is very easy to underestimate that sort of those. So I was going to say basic skills, but they're not basic. It's not easy to, you know, walk into a group of 25 footballers and put them in the right places and send them out with clear instructions about what they're going to do that they absolutely believe in. And Sam Allardyce has been doing that for a very long time. The one other thing I was going to say is I like Alisson, just in my ignorance, I don't know what ballet looks like when it's good to enjoy, never mind when it's not good to enjoy. So maybe that's safe. That is said in complete ignorance.
You have to like the music. I just wanted to say, if you want, one way I would sum up Sam Allardyce for people who don't quite get him on why he's so successful, because he has this amazing record in the top flight of taking over as the firefighter. I sat down with him when he was out of work, and he went, he's one of those people that's quite prepared to sit down and say, I'm really good at this, I'm really good at that. I mean, he'll tick off. And he manages to do it without sounding like egotistical as well. Anyway, he was the first manager really to go into stats in a big way. He likes telling people that, and he's continued to always use statistics, gather information. He likes big backroom stuff and so on. But this, I think, sums up Big Sam. So he's really passionate about the statistics, the information at hand, preparing for the opposition. But when he was manager with Bolton, he had to go to Chelsea, and he had quite a lot of injuries, and he decided, right, we're not going to train. If we do any training out on the pitch, we might get more injuries. Or the people who are marginal, they might become injured. So we're not doing any training. We're going to have a snooker tournament, darts tournament, and a pool tournament. We're not going to tell anybody we've done this in case it backfires, but that's how we're preparing for a football match. And they went and they won, which is why he was able to tell me that's how they'd prepared for it. So he's your combination of your old school, you know, that's the sort of thing you think of from the 1970s, isn't it? Ah, we all played cards and then we played darts and it was, you know, we had a few drinks. It's a combination of that and the modern, complete opta-obsessed, packs on the back, what's your heart rate like manager. And he's able to juggle all of that so that he can come into a club and he will literally turn them around. And we saw the beginning of that at Anfield.
Liverpool fraying slightly, Gregor. Got Newcastle next, big game against Southampton, Villa in the cup, but then Manchester United, Burnley, and then Spurs. And when I say fraying slightly, I just mean, are we starting to feel maybe a little bit of fatigue from some of the younger players who've had to come in? Reece Williams, Curtis Jones as well, just the responsibility on their shoulders given some of the big players who are out.
I think when Matip went off injured and Williams came on, you just saw a bit of fragility there. There was Carlin Grant went through once, and he, you know, there was no way Williams was catching him. as you say, Jones gave the ball away just before the corner kick that led to the goal, I think it was. I wouldn't throw too much in that. I think the main thing is fragility at the back. You know, Fabinho's been really good. And Matip, obviously, is injury prone. So there's, with January coming into view, it will kind of, depending on how long Matip's out, can they rely on Williams and players from the academy to step in with the volume of fixtures they've got on all different fronts? I think that's where the fragility is personally. You know, they were still in the first half, you know, dominant and had other chances. I wouldn't read too much into that personally. I just think at the back, that's the biggest issue for them.
You saw that. We saw that with the goal, didn't you? When you say the Fabinho being bullied for that goal, you know,
yes.
It'd be no surprise if teams, you know, just to see that one moment and think, right, okay, this is something we're going to target. So obviously, you know, it's going to take good delivery and good, you know, it's going to take good implementation, but it's a fairly obvious direct route to trying to find Liverpool's soft centre.
Alison, anything on Liverpool?
Well, it was for all I've bigged up Sam Allardyce, it was a free goal. Do you see the spin on it? Ridiculous. I mean, that happens once every million years, doesn't it? So there was something slightly freaky about it, the whole 2 points dropped.
I think you've waded into the bear team lost territory there, Alison. The managers didn't want to do it, but don't worry, Alison Rudd will fill the void on that one. Let's move on to VAR, everyone's favorite, the video assistant referee system. It's changed again. Maybe not the system itself, but the way it's being adjudged, let's call it that. I wouldn't even call it implementation. The officials in the Premier League seemed extra officious, let's call it that. Every slight touch was being persecuted to the nth degree, and now it seems like they've gone back on that. The clear and obvious error seems to have been taken away, really, and certainly it's not being judged as tightly, because this weekend I think Burnley will feel probably the most aggrieved, but there were so many different incidents that we could have spoken about. Ilan Meslier, the Leeds United goalkeeper, apparently was fouled by Burnley defender Ben Mee before Ashley Barnes put the ball in the back of the net. And that wasn't overturned. Could not believe it. Nick Pope, the Burnley goalkeeper, then gave a penalty away. For me, just my opinion, massively harsh. It seemed like he kicked the ball at exactly the same time as Patrick Bamford. I couldn't see how he'd fouled him, really, to be perfectly honest with you. There was a harsh-ish looking handball, but those are the rules for Brighton defender Lewis Dunk as well. That led to a goal being disallowed. But Matt, it seems like, if I can simplify this, VAR is sticking by the ref more.
Well, I think obviously they've read that illuminating David Ellery interview that was exclusive in the Times a few weeks ago. Now, I mean, we're not complaining about this, are we? But the world wanted clear and obvious to be. That's how the VAR was devised. That made sense about how VAR was devised. It was written into VAR, and Ellery went out of his way to make the point that that is how it needs to work. And if we are steering back towards a more clear and obvious, then this is a good thing, right? I mean, on the Leeds things, I'd say a couple of things. First of all, the penalty decision, if you are going on the clear and obvious, you had to watch the footage 25 times to work out is it ball then man then ball, is it reckless force or not reckless force. The referee gave it thinking it was a penalty. If you're going VAR is only for clear and obvious, it stays a penalty. Simple as that. That's how we want the rules to be interpreted. On the other one, that was a terrible decision by a referee, you know, just to hold off your whistle for a couple of seconds. I mean, it was a mistake in the first place. Then it's a double mistake to blow so fast. But in that instance, as far as I'm aware, because he's blown, and even Sean Dyche accepted this, VAR can't intervene because the referee. So that's not a VAR debate. That's a separate debate of just bad refereeing. So, but on the wider point, if we are getting back more towards clear and obvious, isn't this an alleluia moment?
Well, no, I should have mentioned the Arsenal penalty as well. Kieran Tierney going down really easily.
Well, so that, again, that's the clear and obvious. I mean, the referee gives it. There, you had to watch it 17 times to work out is there's not contact with the left foot. there is actually a bit with the right foot. There is enough to, you have to watch it 10 times to decide, is that a penalty or not? Therefore,
but in my opinion, clear and obvious should work in one direction, especially when it comes to penalties. Penalties should be given if they're clearly a foul in the box. And I think VAR should overturn it if it's clearly not a foul in the box. And I think there are a couple. Well, I don't know. I thought, for example, Nick Pope's was clearly not a foul. And I thought Rhys James had clearly not done enough to take Kieran Tierney off his feet. And so it shouldn't, neither of them should have been penalties.
I thought people looked at the left foot and it was like, oh, he hasn't caught that foot. But then actually, I think Tierney's right foot does, there is contact. But the bottom line is you have to watch
it. He's already diving. He was already going down.
The one thing I would say is that Rhys, I mean, I was there at the game. I can't remember Rhys James sort of jump. I remember the look on his face was, I've just got on the wrong side and I've just given away a penalty.
But that was put to me as well at the weekend. Well, Rhys James accepted it, so it couldn't have been a foul. And I was like, well, so if he was ranting and raving and screaming, then you would have said it the other way. No, it's not a foul.
I just think that's illuminating. Again, one thing that it was in that Ellery piece was that this idea that of referees giving the game what it expects. That is part of refereeing for referees, because it is subjective, because it is not perfect. And even as we use the in VAR system, that there is still that overriding ambition of officiating to give the game what it expects. And in that instance, I think the game got what it expected, which was that a player on the wrong side stuck a foot in and there was a tangle and the advancing player went down. If you watch that 10 times and decide it's not a penalty, that okay, fine. But then you're back into saying, well, I have had to watch it 10 times to decide it. And then you're getting away from clear and obvious. So basically, there's going to be no pleasing, there's going to be no pleasing you, because either way, people are going to be naffed off with the situation.
There's false logic at work here, Matt, because if the referees are behaving differently because of VAR and the players are behaving differently. So the referee knows he can blow the whistle because he thinks there might have been contact. It's much better to blow the whistle and then be proven that there was or wasn't contact. And it's now increasingly likely it'll be proven that he's right and he did see contact, because players are making sure there is minimal contact as they fall down. Because when they're looking in Stockley Park at the replays and they see, oh, well, the referee gave the penalty, there was contact, how on earth can we overrule this? So you're creating a different form of football by automatically having VAR there. It's different. The referee does not want to blow the whistle, does not want to let play go on, and then Stockley Park say, you missed it, in case something important happens later. So you pull it all back. And what I would say is, we've got this system in place and we've got people in charge who are not ready to be in charge of it. For example, one reason I think it'd be absolutely amazing if you could mic up the Stockley Park and the referees and let us hear the reasons and the discussions between them. And the reason they're not letting us do that is because they would sound like utter idiots, because they're not trained properly yet in how to do it. You say, oh, even you just said, Matt, they because the referee blew his whistle too early in the Burnley match, they couldn't review. Of course they could have reviewed it, because they weren't reviewing the goal. They were reviewing a penalty claim. And the idea that both the referee on the field and the referee at Stockley Park both thought you weren't allowed to review that decision is ridiculous. Because if you're in a game and there's been a penalty ignored by the referee and the other team go up the field and score a goal, you can still go back and look at the penalty appeal and then knock off the goal, which is all part of this ridiculous cycle of psychological torture for everybody involved.
And maybe we should just have half the season with it and half the season without it, and then everyone can decide at the end which they prefer more.
One I'd also add that the first thing Alison said is the most pertinent. It is changing the way that the game is played, and it's changing the way that referees are refereeing. I think they would give a penalty now more easily and more kind of straightforwardly, and think, well, we've got the kind of backup here. But then there's people at Stockley Park are going, no, do we really want to kind of cross them here? And that Kieran Tierney dived. I love Kieran Tierney, but that was a dive. He was going down before there was any contact. And the other thing is, I did that piece a while back about, and I think at the end of September, about how many bookings there have been for simulation. There's still been two since March, two bookings. The last one was Dan James when he got clotheslined by by Cooper against Leeds. That was a nonsense as well. But it just doesn't happen anymore because everything's slowed down so much, and it's like if you can pick the contact. You know, Matt said you could see a marginal contact, but Tierney was already, his leg was straight out behind him to initiate the contact, and he was going over. The other one was Fabio Silva at Wolves. These tiny little things now. You see him, he poked the ball, and then somebody clipped the back of the bottom of his studs, probably, and he's kind of done the two legs together and flop. And you wouldn't be surprised to see that given as a penalty now. That was the thing. That's so sad. You watch that happen, you think that could quite easily be given as a penalty these days. It pains me to watch what now constitutes a penalty.
I think that's the issue for me as well. I was having this argument on social media. Contact is now seemingly a foul. What we saw between Reece James and Kieran Tierney, for example, even if you said there was contact, where was the foul? And that was my point. It was like, well, maybe he did touch the back of his leg, but did he foul him? He never fouled him at any point. There wasn't a foul. So that's what I mean when I say there's a clear and obvious error, because even if you said Reece James touched the back of his calf, he didn't foul him. He didn't make him hit the ground. And Kieran Tierney said in his post-match interview, I felt contact. He was asked, was it a foul? And he said, I felt a bit of contact, so I went down. And that's apparently how professional footballers view the situation, because they can, because...
Let's just also be clear. You take away VAR and there is still a defender on the wrong side putting a foot in. There is a guy going down. There is a tangle of legs and a referee's probably still given a penalty. So,
that's true.
We're not...
But this is what it's for, correct these things.
But then we're back into the debate of how much we are trying to correct. But all I'm just saying is, VAR is now getting the blame for players diving or for that confusion. The fact is there would be that confusion. The alternative without VAR is that Tierney goes down, the referee probably gives a penalty, and on Match of the Day or on this show, we say, God, another useless ref. So, okay, let's go back to that world, but let's just be prepared to go back to a world where we're saying bloody useless ref or diver player or whatever.
But my issue, Matt, is around the system. The system is working one way. Clear and obvious will be to give a decision in the future, but it won't be to overturn one. And that's my issue with it. It has to work both ways. If you see something that should be overturned because it's not a clear foul, but then the other way around, you say, "Yeah, exactly, exactly."
There are clearly at least a couple on this podcast who think that the Tierney one was a howler, who think that the Leeds. The Bamford issue was a howler. I didn't think either were howlers. I thought they were ones that took me at least five replays, going on 10, to decide exactly what they were. And I'm still not sure that you could say, 100%, oh my God, how did he do that? How did he give that? Or, oh my God, how did, you know?
I think that in itself is sad. I mean, even when you see the as I said, I've seen before, that Pope's challenge, How does he stop Bamford from scoring that goal? If one time he gets an opportunity to win the ball because the ball is out of Bamford's kind of reach, it's marginally too big a touch perhaps, that's the chance for the goalkeeper to win the ball. And he goes and he wins the ball. And there's no way you can win the ball without following through and hitting Bamford. I've seen people suggest that on Twitter that he put his hands out after, so there was a foul after he won the ball. I mean... It just depresses me, honestly. You can't win the ball in the penalty box. It's actually madness to try and win the ball. But even when it's thinking of, if he doesn't do it then Bamford's round him and scores. So I think it's sad that you can't make a tackle like that anymore. And even actually when you do win the ball, it's still deemed a foul. And it wasn't reckless. It wasn't dangerous.
Yeah, but I guess maybe ultimately there'll be some referees who wouldn't give it, and it wouldn't be overturned the other way either. I mean, that's a fact. I mean,
But that should be a penalty in all games, particularly when you've got an on-field referee and you've got VAR to back it up. So if that is a penalty against Nick Pope, it should be a penalty against any goalkeeper that makes exactly the same challenge. There should be some consistency to it.
No, you can't. You can't. You know, you're, this is the whole point.
Easier said
you've got
done.
An on-field referee. You've got people watching it at Stockley Park. Between the two of them, they should be able to make decisions more consistent, not less.
Because that is a classic decision where, you know, we're judging a microscopic view of which ball first or man. B with, I guess, looking at force of tackle or whether it's justified, et cetera, et cetera. But that tackle, say, Gregor doesn't think it's a penalty. I can understand that point of view. I can easily see that if the referee doesn't give it, VAR aren't overturning it the other way.
But Matt, here's my point.
Area is allowed. It's going to happen.
No, Matt, here's my point. If they use Pope versus Bamford to train VAR referees at Stockley Park, they should be able to play that video and say, if you're on the VAR, this decision is X or Y.
But that's another. But when I, you know, again, sorry to be plugging this interview to the point where people must think, I've got shares in IFAB or something. But Ellery, you know, as Ellery said, went through a number of decisions with him and said, you know, two or three of them were right. You know, same with handballs; they were right in that grey area where half the referees will give it, half won't. He said that's even at the elite level. I'm afraid there is going to be stuff
on the field or off it though. I understand on the field of play, Pope versus Bamford might have been given either way by the referee on the field. But what I'm saying is then with VAR as a safety net afterwards, you should come to what they could all say, IFAB or others, is the right decision, surely.
But then you don't believe in clear and obvious then. That's, you're just saying that on the one hand, you want clear and obvious, but on the other hand, I do.
Believe in clear and obvious. I do believe in clear and obvious in that when you play Bamford versus Pope, you should say that's not clearly and obviously a foul, so it's not a penalty. So you should be able to say, as the VAR, unless that was clearly a foul, you shouldn't be giving it. And it wasn't clearly a foul. To be honest, you think it was clearly a foul.
But that's not what clear and obvious is. They think clear and obvious error by the referee.
Clear and obvious error,
which is a fault in itself. I mean... If you've got the
but
technology,
for me it was a clear and obvious
you're relying upon the referee's decision to. It's the same with the Mesley one, the foul on me. It's like if that is not something that VAR should intervene in, then I really don't know what the point is.
Well, the reason they didn't intervene is they forgot they were allowed to. So why are you putting so much faith into a system that can forget why it's there?
Alison, just finally on this, I know you're not very happy about it. Does it distort the competition, the Premier League, to have really extra officious VARs at the start of the season and then become really sort of laid back about it halfway through?
Well, I suppose. I suspect they will keep mucking this up throughout. This isn't like we've had half a season one way and then we're going to have
mucking up. Right.
I was trying very hard not to be rude. Yes. It's going to get a lot worse before it gets better because they're already running to rectify the mistakes they've made by, as you say, trying to play around with this clear and obvious error. Oh, let's not undermine the referee on the pitch. And they haven't had the intelligence to think why, you know, this is changing the way referees behave on the pitch. There's a big philosophical point with VAR is that it's changed the entire game of football and the relationship with the officials. And they're unable to see they're in the play of this. This is a theatre and they're unable to see how the script has worked out. They're lurching from trying to win the PR battle from week to week. So there will be something else ludicrous coming. But I didn't want VAR, but I do feel if you're going to have it, they should have trained people for far longer, far, far longer behind the scenes before they let them loose. Because there's been a lot of panicking behind the scenes, there's been a lot of irrationality. I don't see how a qualified referee sat in front. It's counterintuitive, actually, to ask referees to do this, because they've been told throughout their entire career, do not look at screens. Do not re-referee the game yourself. Do not try and look at a half time and then come back and award a penalty to even things up. They have been told to not do that, and suddenly you're placing all the people that in VAR are referees. So they just swap roles every week, and they're not trained properly on how to assess a game via technology.
They did train for at least a year more than most other major leagues, 2 years more than other major leagues. I mean, the whole point is the Premier League actually held off from VAR to let others to see the other glitches elsewhere and to train for longer. So, I mean, you can say that, well, that means they're obviously training them badly, but, you know, you can't, the Premier League certainly didn't rush into VAR.
Well, they didn't train them for the right things. They trained them thinking it was going to be something it is not. They trained them to think they were going to just review a case of mistaken identity when somebody is sent off. And that's all they thought they were going to do. They didn't think they were going to be this relentless rerunning of incidents that would then change the way referees behaved. So you've collapsed in on itself if you've now got a system that wants to back referees and the referees are making the wrong decisions because of VAR in the first place. It's
I think they've trained them for one thing, and then they're changing it as they go along because the game isn't sure what it wants from it either. I mean, we could sit here and talk about it for several hours, get 20 different people on with 20 different opinions. The fact is that it is changing the game. It's changing how people play, how people look at it, how people talk about it, how we argue about it. And that's changing what people want from it. And they're trying to adapt with that. Now, either you've got patience to see that glitches through, or you probably want to chuck it in the bin. But I think the idea that they are sort of doing it all just because they're sitting there thinking I'm going to screw everyone's fun over is probably unfair. I think they're basically trying to make it up as they go along in a game that's changing with it. Opinions are changing with it, and trying to keep up with the game changing opinions.
So a game worth billions of pounds, the game that was supposed to improve our mental health in the pandemic, the most important sport in the world, and you're now happy that there's a referee, a bit uncomfortable, sat in front of a screen, making it up as he goes along. Ridiculous.
No, I'm saying they're adapting to how the game is changed, what the game views from it. It wanted perfect handball. We've realised you can't get perfect handball. It wanted to intervene where it can. Then it's realised, actually, no, we get better go back to clear and obvious error.
I love how we talk about it like it's this kind of life form of itself.
I'll come back. I always come back to the point I always start with, which, you know, it's sort of, I feel like sometimes I'm on a desert island, sort of clinging to this little flag out there, sort of probably a desert island, probably on my own by now, but just sort of thinking if we can't work out a system that works for enough people to be satisfied with it, then we're not very clever. But maybe we are.
I don't think we are. Yeah, that's the truth.
And this is football. Yeah, and it's football, and you only have to, you know, revel in the madness of it, whether that's on a park pitch or the top of the game, to see that football makes us all mad in enjoyable and other ways. To maybe realise that VAR is just sort of too. Oh, there's too much logic and sort of, I don't know, too much. Yeah, maybe there is too much precision in it, or too much something in it that's never going to satisfy enough people. We're always going to be screaming and shouting about it because that's what we do about football. We scream and shout.
And it explains why Reece James didn't. The reason Reece James didn't make a song and dance about it when the referee blew his whistle and gave a penalty against him was because he knew there'd been some form of contact, and he knows that VAR will see some form of contact, even if it was irrelevant contact.
He also knew he screwed up because Tierney had done him on the turn and it got him on the wrong side, basically.
Yeah, I agree. Still not a foul, though, whether he complained or not. Look, since the referees are now back in centre stage, the ones on the field, of course, I thought we'd just end on our biggest we was robbed moment back when the referees on the field of play were king. And I think I'll start with mine, which was clearly Paul Scholes against Jose Mourinho's Porto at Old Trafford. They knocked Man United out of the Champions League. The rest is history. Spurs fans can thank the referee on that evening for the Jose they now have. Because he was about 2 yards onside, it was rolled across the box, he tapped it in, and it was given as an offside. And it is still by far one of the worst decisions in football in history for me. No need to go into Hand of God or Luis Suarez on the goal line against Ghana, because that for me was as bad as it gets. Man United were robbed on that evening in the Champions League. Gregor, what about you as a player?
As a player... I can remember watching games an Old Firm game when George Cadetti scored a goal that was ruled off for offside. That was like in a really tight title race between the Old Firm, and it was the most ridiculous decision that I've ever seen. Like, he was yards and yards and yards onside. So that's kind of brings it back to the fact that, you know, we do need it in some form, because howlers like that are, you know, although they're rare, they we don't want them in the game. But that was probably the single worst decision I could ever remember. But playing, I mean, I have to say, the standard, if you think the standard officiating is bad in the Premier League, you should see it in the Football League and down in the lower leagues. Sometimes it was just truly, truly awful. I can't think of any one single howler, though. Come back to me.
You've given us one. I'm happy with the effort put forth in the Old Firm. Matt?
See, I'm refusing to indulge in this terrible baiting of officialdom. This is just teed up to have another go at officials. And did I bore you with the fact that I was running the line a couple of weeks ago and I gave an offside, ruled out a goal that this kid scored in the top corner, and he called me an effing C-word. I just, there I was in my flag, with my flag on a Sunday morning, you know, come out for a nice bit of fresh air, watch my kid play football, and some spotty teenager screaming four-letter abuse at me for about 3 minutes. I thought, this is a bloody mugs game. I think I'm going to go and get a cup of tea. I'd always go back to the hand of God, mostly because I remember hurling a book across the living room when, as soon as I realised it was handball. And you don't get more robbed than in a World Cup quarter final, do you? Even though obviously they were always going to win it because they had Maradona.
This is more a confession, really. I was playing for Leighton Orient Ladies, and the referee just sort of said, blew his whistle and said offside to me. And I spent the next, oh dear, I spent the next 10 minutes running next to the referee, going in his ear, do you know what offside is? Do you know what offside is? Do you know you're allowed to be level? Do you know you're allowed to be level? Because I was level. I mean, are you stupid? Do you not know what offside is? And it is weird how in the sort of heat of play and desire to win, you forget all your principles. And oh dear. So, but you know, I was right, he was wrong. It was I was so clear on it. So in some respects, I have huge respect for players who don't do that, who don't just run around after the referee shouting in his ear, do you not know what offside is?
I was one, I have to admit as well, to give the referee a lot of abuse when I was playing, even on Sunday League. But as I matured, I realised that the game is nothing without them. We can't have it without the ref. So Matt, a final positive note for the referees, you know, as bad as they might be, whether that be at Stockley Park or Hackney Marshes, the game is nothing without them. In fact, the Game Podcast is nothing without you guys. Thanks for listening this week. We'll be back soon. As I say, it's a very busy Christmas schedule, but you can get yourself a digital subscription to the Times and Sunday Times. You'll get more, not just of us here on the podcast, but of course, the award-winning journalism from the Times, from the likes of Greg and Matt and Ali as well. You can maybe give someone a subscription right now. Sign up today. You'll get yourself 1 month free. Just go online, search thetimes.co.uk/thegame to get started. We will be back on Thursday. We'll see you then.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.